This is Jane McGonigal, the author of Super Better and a big fan of the Psych Tech Podcast. You're listening to Psych Tech Podcast, where you will get the future of psychology and technology.
Welcome to Psych Tech, the Psychology and Technology Podcast. My name is Osoy Cardona, and I'm with my host, Kelly Dunlap. What's up, Kelly?
RT that, for sure.
All right, so we're getting right into it. I like it. People have things to do. No time for chit-chat.
No, it's all about that micro-blogging. Oh, my goodness. Micro-blogging, insta-communication experience, that's why.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we need to limit our characters and just keep moving.
I am claiming micro blobbing though. I don't know what I could possibly use it for, but I'm claiming that right now.
Trademark it.
Yeah, trademark. That's what I'm looking for. Micro blobbing.
That may be the name of today's episode. Right. So micro blogging is like Twitter and to a certain extent like Tumblr, things like that. Anyway, but I saw this article this week that really had me. It's something that's been on my mind. It was a Motherboard article. I'm convinced Motherboard is my favorite website. I don't think anybody comes close at this point. And they had this article called "Never Retweet. It's Making You Stupid." And it's funny because when I read it first, I wasn't sure exactly what it meant by it. Like when you hear that, what do you think it means?
When I read the title, I was thinking it's representing yourself in a not good way, because if you are retweeting something, the idea is it's a knee-jerk reaction and you probably didn't actually read or carefully read what it is that you are retweeting. You're just kind of like, oh yeah, okay, spam that.
That's exactly what I thought when I read the headline. I was like, huh, but that's what, well, why would you say it's making you stupid? Well, it turns out that it's actually citing a study from the Computers and Human Behavior Journal. And what these researchers did was that they had people read articles, and then there were two different groups, and they gave the option to one group to retweet it, reshare the actual article if they wanted, and the other one did not have the option. And the people who shared it, well, everybody got a test afterwards, like a reading comprehension test to see if they understood what was going on, and the people who retweeted or shared the article did worse, right? And on the comprehension test. And so there's more to the study, but I've been thinking about that a lot lately because on like my other podcast and site that I work with, Geek Therapy, about a year ago we started doing this thing where we were going to catalog different types of media that we saw that we thought might be useful in either therapy situations or in education, essentially like conversation starters or ways to just really good examples of things that people could relate to if they were dealing with different issues, whether good or bad, things like that. So recently I was talking to my partner over there and she was telling me that, you know, like it stopped being fun to consume media. Like I was watching things, but I was constantly thinking about, well, you know, then I have to catalog it and what category am I going to put it in and what am I going to say about it? And it started like interfering with the enjoyment of the thing. And I don't know if the same happens to you for here, for Psych Tech. Like sometimes I'm reading something and I'm thinking like, huh, do I want to use that? Should we use it? Does that happen to you here?
Not really. Stuff? At least for Psych Tech, no, because if I see something that catches my eye and I think it would make a really good, or it might make an episode, I just dump it into our Slack channel for possible future ideas. There's no commitment to it. It's not like I have to categorize it. It's not like I have to make a show around it. It's just an idea that was interesting and I just throw it out there. And so I think that's probably the main difference, is that if every article I thought about putting into our idea channel, I had to actually orchestrate an agenda around, I'd probably hate that and would resist doing it. But because it's a low cognitive load and it's a low time kind of task, like, oh, just drop the link, it again, there's no pressure. There's no feeling that, you know, I have to make something more of this. If it works, it works. If it doesn't, that's fine too.
We do have a great system.
We do.
And what about in terms of gaming, right? So you do a lot of like in-depth, more, you know, studying of games. Do you ever find yourself like playing a game and then having to stop and be like, oh, I need to write this down? Or
no, actually, I'm playing a game, I'm very much in the experience of the game, which I think is something that I'm going to come back to later in the show. But if something really strikes me, I'll go, oh, that's cool. And then I'll keep going. So I don't, when I'm gaming specifically, I don't really pull myself out of the experience. And mostly because I play most games multiple times. So I know that if I need to come back to it, I can. Or, for example, you know, if I'm just reading for fun and I find something that would be a really good post for my website, or it might be an article I want to submit a paper to for a conference, I'll whip out Evernote, jot down the idea that I had, put in the link, and then that's it. And I'm back to doing whatever I wanted. So I guess you could say I really quarantine or have really good boundaries around what I do for fun and then what I do for grown-up professional work.
You know, so I have a really, really tough time splitting the two, because almost everything that I enjoy, I have also tied it to some sort of project. So I'm constantly on this mode where I'm like scanning, right, for things. And it's not uncommon for me to open up Evernote to start jotting down a note, or I'll pause something, or, you know, and then I have all these different notebooks for different types of ideas of things that I might want to do. And it's really, really hard for me. So like, the way that we use our Slack channel, I really like it, because I can read the article and I dump it there for later. And then, again, we'll just look at it, right? And maybe, you know, maybe after you see it too, it's like, oh, well, you know, that's good or not good. Like, we can actually comment on it and think about that part later.
Yeah.
On my browser, I use Pocket.
I do too. I was just going to say, I love Pocket.
Oh, yeah.
So for those who don't know, Pocket is an app where if you see something, all you have to do is click the link. And if you have Pocket installed, it'll send it to this little app on your phone that you can access offline, which is really important to me. And it just kind of keeps it there. It's like bookmarking, but smart bookmarking. So again, if I'm reading this really interesting article or I'm doing something that's really fun and this other thing pops up, I'm like, oh, I really want to read about that. I'm notorious for this in my Twitter feed. If I'm scrolling through my Twitter feed and I see an article, I'm like, ooh, I want to read that later. It instantly goes into Pocket. And then I do go back and I read it later, because when I'm reading my Twitter feed, it's really about just scanning kind of 140 character bits of information. I don't necessarily want to stop at every interesting article and do the full read. So for me, it's, you know, kind of saving it for later.
You know how on the iPhone it has the new 3D touch feature?
Yes, I do.
And you can like... you can just like click on something and it'll pop up a little bit.
Yeah.
I love that. I wish we had that feature everywhere. So you just like sneak in. It's like, oh yeah, yeah, that first paragraph is good. Pop out and then just send it to Pocket. And I love Pocket because it is just a button, and then I can close the browser window and it doesn't matter. It'll be on that list later. It's like I used to use Instapaper back in the day. You could do it with Evernote, but it's a little harder.
Yeah.
It's like two or three more clicks and steps, because Evernote has you do the tagging and it gives it a title and it does all this extra stuff.
I think the nice thing and what we're kind of getting at here is we're finding things that we're interested in, but we're not having to invest our full resources when those resources are dedicated to something else at the moment. And I really, that's how I felt about this Never RT, It's Making You Stupid article, is if you are, so first of all, I tried to look at the study, but it's behind a paywall. So I don't know the procedures. I don't know the methods. I don't know exactly what the author did, although I'm sure through my university I could probably get a copy, and maybe we'll do a part two. But if somebody is tasked with, hey, read this article, and another person is tasked with, read this article so you can retweet it, you're asking for two really different kinds of cognitive engagement. So one, read this article. You are in it. You are focusing on the content, on what's being written, on what's being developed, what the author is saying, because you are reading it because that is the goal, as opposed to if you're told that there's something else attached to it. So not only do you have to read this article, but then we're going to want you to tweet about it. you're now reading the article, but you're also now looking for 140 character snippets or hook lines, tag lines, something that is much more superficial because you're doing it for Twitter as opposed to really diving into the meat of the content itself. So that's my biggest kind of question for this particular study is what exactly were the directions the participants gave?
Yeah, and my understanding is that they were given the option to share. And I think that just by suggesting that they have the option, right? I don't know the specific numbers, right, of how big the group was and how many people opted to share versus not share. And I agree that if they were forced to share, it would be different.
I think,
but just having
the option, I think the option though is even worse because now not only are you reading with the idea that you know, because if you're forced to retweet something, at least you're looking for those snippets. You know, you have a task and a mission that's related to conveying the content of the article. Whereas if you have the option of sharing, now you're bringing emotion into the issue because is this something that I want to share? Is this something that speaks to me at not just the scientific or cognitive level, but at the emotional level where I would want to share it with my friends? Is this piece somehow reflective of who I am as a person? And so I feel like there's even more cognitive load going on because you're asking so much more of a person rather than just comprehension. You're now asking them to comprehend, synthesize, and then make a limbic level decision on whether or not they want to share this information with somebody.
Agreed. And that is more representative of what it's really like to be online.
Right. Right.
Especially if you're the type of person who, I don't know how to categorize people who do this. Like I follow a lot of people who retweet a lot of stuff. Some, like I can just imagine them sitting down and torturing themselves about having to write something witty when they quote something else, right?
Mm-hmm.
And some people do it because, you know, professionally that's who they are. They're supposed to be insightful about this thing or the other thing. I've moved away from that a lot. I don't think I ever did it very much because I didn't enjoy it.
Right.
But I do see the professional benefits of being like, oh, like I want to know what Kelly says about this article. Let me go see her feed and see if she commented on that. And like you said, there's a lot going on. And then to be reading something, like, and that's assuming that you're reading it one time, and while you're reading it, you're thinking ahead to what your tweet is going to look like. Mm-hmm. And it could be, Twitter limits your due to 140 characters, and that's one challenge. But if you're going on Facebook or somewhere else,
right,
or you're just gonna like write an essay on the article for your blog, there's a whole lot of other stuff going on. And like, at what point are you actually studying it deeper to give that analysis? Or are you just thinking about what it's going to look like or sound like on your feed and then do it? And again, the point of the article is that, or that study, that their conclusions were that by doing that, that when you do that, you just, like, you're not paying as much attention to the details, and you may even be misunderstanding the content because your mind is on that next step.
And there's also the issue of cognitive dissonance. So, for example, if there is an article and the title of it, you feel like, yes, this is me, and you start reading through it, and you're in one particular frame of mind, you know, cognitive dissonance kicks in when information that is contrary to your belief is presented to you. You're much less likely to pay attention to it. You're much less likely to give it any kind of valence or credence, and you just kind of ignore it and move on. So I could definitely see somebody who looks at an article and initially agrees with what the article's saying, maybe tweeting it out, whether they read the whole thing and then just kind of ignored the parts they disagreed with, or maybe didn't even read the entire article. And that obviously would impact their understanding because they're emotionally tapping into something that they want to share. And we know that emotion and reason and comprehension don't necessarily go hand in hand. So what I want to know, Josue, what was the last thing you retweeted where you actually put some kind of comment in it?
Man, can I check my feed?
Yeah, of course, of course. So okay. I have a clear example, so I'll throw that out there while you're looking. The last thing I retweeted there, I follow I think it's called Cute Animals on Twitter. And it was a GIF of a trunk, like an SUV pop-up trunk full of pugs. And there's had to be at least a dozen, maybe two dozen pugs in the back of this large SUV. And they're all smiling and panting and looking with their bulgy eyes. And so I retweeted and I added the quote at my buddy Stein, who is somebody I know through Xbox. And I know he has two pugs and loves pugs. And so I said, you know, this is Stein's dream car. And I retweeted it so that everybody could see it, but it was also directed at him. And I mean, I know that's not the same as reading an article and trying to comprehend it, but to me, when I think about RTs, that's what I'm thinking about, is I'm thinking who would enjoy the content that I'm sharing. And in this case, it happened to be a bunch of happy, panting pugs to somebody who I know likes pugs.
I assume the audience is just anybody that's following me, right? So I don't usually tag a specific person. Mm-hmm. So the last one I found where I actually said something. So I quoted the original tweet, and it was a PC – what is it? It was a PC Games Network article where they were talking about a video game that got a price cut and why that happened. And I commented on, yep, it worked on me, and I'm enjoying it. And so it was the type of – it was more like a comment that I would have put at the bottom of the article. Mm-hmm. And I chose to comment on – Twitter instead. It wasn't an insight or anything. It was a reaction to, and maybe a conversation with the author kind of comment. But I did include it because I thought, oh, well, somebody else might benefit from learning that information.
So the next question is, have you ever retweeted something without actually reading it? Because I will totally own up to that. There's a couple people who, Chris Ferguson, who I follow on my Twitter account, he's a video game, he's a psychologist who focuses a lot on media and video games in particular. There's Yan Tang, who is a newly crowned doctor of psychology, who does a lot of really interesting research on video games and mental health, psychology, social interaction. Andrew Shabilsky, who we've talked about a couple times.
Andy.
Yeah. And if they're posting something like, hey, check out this really cool article, I won't even read it. I trust them so much that sometimes it's just an Insta retweet, but then I take the link and I put it in Pocket and save it for later, which I do understand that might not be the smartest way for me to do something. But again, it goes to the idea that this is something that I have a very good idea that I'm going to like and agree with, so I'm just going to retweet it. And even if I don't, at least it's an interesting conversation coming from people who I trust and who have interesting conversations, whether I agree with their view or not. So it's kind of like, you know, down ticket voting. You know, if you're a Democrat and you don't know necessarily who, or rather if you are of a particular affiliated party and you have no idea who this treasurer and school district person and captain of the garbage disposal unit, you'll usually just choose kind of who you already affiliate with, without putting a lot of cognitive processing into it.
So it depends on – I know I've done this with Jane McGonigal's stuff a few
times.
Oh,
yeah, another beautiful example, yeah.
Yeah. but it depends on what they say.
Yeah, like I'll read the tweet
first.
Because
they summarize it. Yeah.
I don't just see
– I don't even read the tweet. I just set it up. Auto-retweet everything.
I see Chris Ferguson's face. I'm like, boop. I don't even care. He's like, I ate spaghetti. Boop. Retweet.
I do trust him almost like 100%. Like I've never heard the man say anything I don't agree with. So those are good examples. I know I've shared, like I once shared a New Yorker article and I read, I'm serious, I must have been reading for like 15 minutes. And then I shared it with my girlfriend, and then when she read it, she told me something about it. And I was like, what? That was in the article? It's because it was like it would have taken me half hour to read the whole thing. Mm-hmm. Because it was so long. I have had that happen. But, you know, the second part of this study, which is really interesting, is that so they had people read and like not be able to share, and then read and be able to share. And then they gave them a second reading, and this one was offline. And then they gave them reading comprehension on that. And then the people who had shared before, again, did worse on the comprehension test. So, I mean, you know, that would suggest, you know, based on this thing, that by us even resharing anything, right, through social media, it's kind of affecting our ability to read and comprehend later. And this goes back to what we're talking about regarding cognitive load, right? It's like if you woke up first thing in the morning and started reading something and then took a test on it, you'd probably do really well compared to having done like a full day of work and watched a show, played a game, driven, had to pick up the kids, you know, cook, clean, do all this other stuff, and then read something and then take the test. So mm-hmm. I think, you know, it doesn't really suggest that much. It's only focusing, again, like it's a controlled study, so it's only focusing on those two or three things. But that's interesting. That would suggest that just the act of engaging online to reshare information is kind of messing with our comprehension of information in general.
I guess the warning sign that I put up on that one is, one, I don't know how long it was between when they were asked to do the experimental task of, you know, read this article and, you know, choose to retweet or not retweet, and then they were presented the article just to read. So on one hand, the group that had just done that, their brain's in that zone. They're already mentally in a space where they are reading just for the joy of reading, or just for because they're told to read. And so they're not actually switching tasks. Whereas somebody who was asked initially to read this article and then do all that kind of processing around, is this sharing? Is this something that I want to share? Is this important for people to know that I know? Is this something that the people around me would benefit from? And now they're being asked to switch tasks. So if it was immediate, that would be my hesitation. If it was 2 hours later, I think it would be a totally different scenario because they've had time to readjust. Or again, I guess if I were to run the study, I would have the group who was asked to do the task, the experimental task of, you know, do you retweet, do you not retweet, have them read an article just for funsies and have them read another article, you know, following that, so that they've had time to make that cognitive switch and they've got the different processes a little bit more in line the way that the control group did.
There was an interesting line in the description of what happened. I think it was in the conclusion where it said that even the understanding of what had happened, like even if they if they remembered certain details, the understanding of the thing that they read was less so. Again, there's a lot of details there that are missing, but I thought it was interesting because, like I said, for me, I find that the other activities that surround the acquisition of information for me are actually intrusive in my enjoyment, and I can't disagree, possibly my understanding of certain things, and definitely the memory aspect, right? If part of my mind is on something like this other task that I'm going to do related to this, I may have skipped a detail or two and possibly overlooked something. And the easiest like comparison for me with this is, you know, when you're taking pictures, right? You're out, you're seeing something like a new place, or you're doing something, you know, just an activity, whatever, visiting a new place. And there are some people who default to have their camera out, right? And they're seeing everything through that camera lens versus just actually taking in the experience. And like I've had like a hatred for cameras for a really long time that comes from that. Like I hate looking at stuff through the lens, and the phone makes it a lot easier, right? But that's why like Instagram is kind of hard for me, because I do not like my mind doesn't immediately go to, oh, that looks really cool, I'm going to take a picture of it. That comes many, many steps later, because I just don't like it. I have like an aversion to using the camera to take in something. And for a while, I used to think, you know what, if I take a picture of it, I will remember it better later. But I've gone back to, no, you know what, I want to enjoy it now and really take it in instead of posting a picture.
I think that is the perfect transition into kind of part two of our is social media ruining everything kind of conversation.
Are you saying it doesn't ruin anything, everything?
I'm saying it doesn't ruin everything. I've had some very positive experiences that are, they're very much opposite. But I think what you're hitting on has been, when I was thinking about this conversation and what I wanted to say, you're talking about the experience, the in-the-moment experience of something. And I'm just going to keep coming back to that again and again. So just be prepared. So the second article that Josue kind of was like, hey, we should really talk about this. And it's actually ties in a little kind of cool because we had somebody tweet at us that they really wanted us to do a Game of Thrones episode. I am totally on board. By the way, I'll find some way to make it related to psych or related to tech.
We're almost there. I mean, we're talking about it now.
We're getting there. The idea that spoilers don't actually ruin everything. And of course, this ties in with social media.
Wait. Did you just say that spoilers don't ruin the experience?
Okay, I will quote the article. Stop worrying about spoilers. They actually help you enjoy the story more. That is what Gizmodo is espousing in this article that they have authored. I do not agree with this article on many, many levels. But again, it's the idea that social media makes things a lot easier to spoil. And, you know, Game of Thrones just was on last night. And I know a lot of people have their Game of Thrones viewing spoiled by social media. And that can have negative effects but this article is kind of arguing the opposite based on some studies that found people enjoyed a spoiled story more than when the story was unspoiled.
Yeah. So, this one, agreed. It's like, it's hard to accept that is true because spoiler culture is a thing and it influences the way that I use social media. Like I won't go on Twitter or Facebook or anything. Like I'm just staying away from my phone at this point. You know, if I haven't watched a show or if we're talking about Game of Thrones, right, it's 9 p.m. on a Sunday, and I can't be home to watch the episode that I'm not, you know, because I don't want it spoiled. Like the idea that having something spoiled before can make you enjoy it more doesn't make sense to me. But what's cool about this article or the studies that are cited in this Gizmodo article are that I think that the only way – because it's almost impossible to test, right? You can't watch something for the first time twice.
Right.
Right? So it's really, really hard. So you have to do it in a way where you know, you have to ask the questions in a certain way and test the people's enjoyment just to see and compare it to other people because there's really no way to – again, I'm going to watch it spoiled and then not spoiled, right? The closest thing is you watch it and then when you watch it a second time – technically, the ending has already been spoiled, right? So, but then you're experiencing it a second time, and you're probably only experiencing it a second time if you liked it the first time. So, then you're definitely going to enjoy it the second time.
So the way the author addressed that issue is instead of, you know, trying to break the space-time continuum and have you experience one thing for the first time twice.
Which would have been better.
Yeah, I think so. More sound methodologically speaking. But he had a control group and an experimental group, which, I mean, is pretty much par for the course in experimental studies that when you can't have first exposure, obviously more than once. So one group got a story to read and they just read it. The experimental group got a story to read and then the plot and outcome of that story were quote unquote spoiled for them. And then they had these two groups rate how much they enjoyed the stories that they read. And the result was that almost all the participants said they enjoyed the spoiled stories more.
Yeah, so the way that it was spoiled, right? It wasn't like somebody came up to them and said, listen, guys, the big surprise is this. Mm-hmm. That's not the way they did it. They kind of had, like, think of it as like they got trailers for the – these are books and written stories. But imagine that you got a trailer for the film and one group got a trailer that didn't reveal plot points and the other one casually kind of showed, you know, the plot points in the trailer. So the preview that they were given or the synopsis, right, either had or did not have the plot point. So it wasn't like spoiler and then they tagged it as that. I think that makes a big difference because of the way that we consume media.
Right. And as I mentioned before, this idea of having the genuine experience in the moment is completely ignored by these studies. And echoing back to, you know, don't ever RT, it's making you stupid. It's all about kind of the emotional experience in the moment of what you're doing. So let's bring it back to Game of Thrones. No spoilers, don't worry, because I'm on the no spoiler camp. But
and actually, so we're going to link to that Gizmodo article, and there's a video there. And that video, like, don't watch the video if you don't want anything spoiled.
I didn't watch it. I didn't click on it.
that video is evil.
Okay.
Because it's coming from a place of like, listen, spoilers don't make it worse. And then it shows some really significant spoilers about things
about Game of Thrones.
It shows Game of Thrones. It also shows like I don't remember ever watching The Usual Suspects, and there's a like it shows something from that movie, and he kind of like, you know, just talks about why, I don't know. So just be warned. Like
this is your
and there's
your
other stuff there too.
Warning.
Yeah. Yeah. For the spoiler video.
So the first thing I thought of was Game of Thrones. It's been really interesting because I have read all the books and my husband has not. So when we were watched all the seasons up until this season, I knew the big plot points that were coming. And he and I had totally different reactions to the same content. So for him, he had this, shocked and upset. And at one point he told me, this is nothing but nihilistic crap. Like, he had really, really strong emotional reactions to some of the events in the show. And I'm just sitting here giggling like, I told you so. It only gets worse. I told you so. Whereas in this season of Game of Thrones, it's now surpassed the books. And so last week's episode, which Hold the Door is the name of the episode. And again, no spoilers, so don't worry. That was really the first time that I experienced that same level of shock and surprise and terror and sadness and all these really intense emotional states, and was left feeling, oh my God, I can't believe that just happened. And so I feel like this is actually getting pretty close to me being able to experience something as someone who has knowledge and as someone who doesn't. And I can tell you it's a very, very different experientially in the moment. Because you've read the books too. Have you found that to be true, Josue?
So I didn't read the books before. I read them afterwards. So, I mean, it's okay. The same thing, just backwards, right?
Yeah.
And that one's tough because, like, the books do go into more detail. So if you like it, there's more to like. Mm-hmm. This is hard because, like, your example is so good. Because how would you define your enjoyment, though? Like, you're talking about the shock, the awe, the surprise, that experience. But what about if you take a step back and you talk about which one you enjoyed more? Like, did you enjoy watching the show? Did you still enjoy watching the show, first of all?
Oh, of course.
Right? And did you enjoy the story? Like, did you enjoy it? Like, these last episodes, I don't know. Game of Thrones is hard, though, because this season has been so good.
I can kind of elaborate a little bit more. So one thing that I have enjoyed more in not knowing is that the idea that I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know who lives, who dies. I don't know where the story arc is headed. And this kind of anticipation and suspense and getting to experience the moment parallel to my husband and parallel to a lot of people that I'm friends with, there's definitely something really special about that. I feel that I'm a part of the experience as opposed to an elitist book reader who's pointing and laughing and going, ah, look at them crying. They didn't see that coming. On the other hand, there is something very enjoyable about knowing what's going to happen. And so there's less anxiety, there's less tension, and my brain is freer to look for other things in the show. So for example, in the first season, I know most of John's time was spent, okay, now who is that? And who is that? And what are they doing? And I don't understand. And it was all of his mental power focusing on the characters and the plot and trying to figure out where everybody fits. Whereas I already know who everybody is, and I can focus on things like foreshadowing and themes and, you know, things that are much more cognitive and analytical. And so I feel like there's two very different experiences. One is in the moment and emotionally driven, And one is more a little bit distance and analytically driven. And they're both really, really enjoyable. And I think that's why people go back and watch something they enjoy over and over and over again. So, for example, last night's episode of Game of Thrones, I was surprised and, you know, not confused, but I was surprised. I had the same, very similar experiences that most everybody else did. And if I go back and watch it again, I'm going to have a different experience because I'm going to be focusing not necessarily on the plot and the character interactions and trying to figure out where things are going. I'm going to be able to attend more to, oh, wow, look at that piece of foreshadowing. Look at that. Look at the parallel storylines that are going on between this character and that character. So I feel like there's two very different kinds of enjoyment that come from it. And I don't think one is necessarily better than the other. But I feel the emotional one, the unspoiled version, is more intense. Now, whether I feel the feeling of nihilistic, oh my God, I can't believe that just happened. Please just rip my heart out. I need therapy, is quote unquote an enjoyable feeling. Probably not. But the experience of having an intense emotion related to characters that I care about in concert with people and in the physical world that I care about and getting to share that experience, I think is really, really enjoyable and really positive.
Yeah, so you don't need to have read the books to enjoy more or less Game of Thrones, right? Like the example that, you know, maybe you're trying to like put everything together and you're confused about what's happening. That's not, I'm sure that's not a unique experience, but it's also not the norm, right? Like the show gives you enough to follow along. But the idea of those moments, right, being the thing that we remember the most, those, again, either the shock or that sharing moment. There was a second study mentioned in the article by the same professor where he essentially just wanted to see, is it the spoilers themselves that are making, you know, is it those moments that are great? So, that are making it more enjoyable. What if we just isolated those experiences? And you really can't do that because it is a full-blown, like there's a lot going on, right? So it's the idea, are you enjoying being shocked and surprised and like solving a mystery, or are you enjoying the acting, the music, the nuances, the actual story progression, the history, the foreshadowing, mm-hmm. all of that? Is it all of it together that you're enjoying, or is it just those moments? And so his study showed that, people, like, their enjoyment of the story or their appreciation of it was not great if they were just given like that plot point, that spoiler, and then that was it, or if you only focus on that one thing. So I think that while those are the most powerful moments, it's definitely not the answer to what makes a show great. And that's why it's so hard to talk about this and agree with those findings if your favorite memories perhaps are those shocking moments, right? But the show is way, way, way more than that. And I mean, we're focusing on Game of Thrones because we just saw the episode last night.
There's kind of a safe way to explore exactly what you're saying. So for example, the movie The Sixth Sense. Now, I do believe that there is an expiration date on spoilers. I remember when Les Mis came out to theaters and somebody complained that Javert died and somebody complained that they spoiled it. I think a 200-year-old book is past the spoiler date. The same thing with The Sixth Sense. So, for example, this piece of media was specifically designed to have this shock value, to have this big plot twist, this big reveal, and that was the intended experience for the audience, very similar to the way that the plot twists and shocking moments of Game of Thrones by themselves are not impactful. Like, if I was to drop the big spoiler from season one, if you've never watched the show, it doesn't mean anything to you. It's out of context. And so I'll use The Sixth Sense instead because that's safer and past the expiration date for spoilers. But going into The Sixth Sense knowing or not knowing that Bruce Willis's character is dead is part of the experience. Like it's intended to, otherwise the reveal doesn't, you don't care. However, if I was to find somebody who hadn't seen The Sixth Sense and I was like, oh yeah, be careful, he's dead the whole time. It's not, they're not going to experience the film in the way that I experienced it when I didn't know. And they might enjoy it more because they'll be able to look at all the times that, oh, yep, look at that foreshadowing, or, oh, you view this particular interaction in a very different way because you know the twist that's coming. But at the end of the day, that quote-unquote twist is no longer impactful for that person. Whereas most people who saw Sixth Sense in the theater or saw it before it was spoiled for them, when you ask them about that movie, that is the point that comes up. And if you were to do a meme or a spoof of The Sixth Sense, that is the most resonant piece of that film, is discovering that the Bruce Willis character is actually already dead, but he doesn't know it. So, I mean, that's kind of, it's like going on the journey with the character, and you learn it as the character learns it, which I feel is really important in engaging storytelling, is that you're going along and, again, I will be very careful with not spoilers. You know, Game of Thrones, the big spoiler in the end of the first season. I just kept thinking, oh, that can happen. That can happen. And this was in the books, too. I remember reading that chapter in the books and then, like, skimming ahead through the rest of the book to see, oh, well, that character didn't happen.
Yeah.
That thing didn't happen. I'm, you know, whatever. Again, I'm trying to be really careful about what I say. So the kind of the disbelief that goes along with it. I think having something spoiled does not mean that everything is spoiled. I think you can still enjoy Game of Thrones if you know everything that happens. The same way that I enjoyed Game of Thrones, the show, where I'd already read all of the books. So in that sense, the show was pretty much spoiled for me, especially the first three seasons, because I knew what was coming. But I still was able to enjoy the show as a piece of art and look at it a little bit more analytically, a little more critically, as opposed to now where I don't know what's coming. It's unspoiled for me. And it's a different kind of enjoyment. That said, don't spoil things. Just don't do it. Because then you're taking away somebody's ability to experience both kinds of enjoyment.
So I'm going to go and be way less. I'm going to actually start agreeing with the article now.
Boo.
Because spoiler culture as it exists now, right, is represented mostly by, like what you're saying, those in-the-moment experiences. And it takes away from, like, the art or the full experience of the thing that you're trying to enjoy. There are some of those things, like the Sixth Sense spoiler. So first of all, yeah, like, it's mind-blowing when you see the movie and then you realize what's been going on the whole time. Going back and seeing the movie again, knowing that, is a very also an entertaining experience, a different experience, but also entertaining. But, like, what the hell is a spoiler? So if I tell somebody about that, that might make them think, oh, that's kind of cool. I want to see that movie, because that sounds a lot more interesting than what the plot of the movie actually you think it is, right? Like, I think that some people, once they find that out, they're like, oh, now I want to see that movie. And that happens a lot, which is, I think that despite how much people hate trailers for films that reveal too many plot points, how many of those reveals in the trailers are actually what get people into the theater in the first place? And so I think that just, like, the idea of spoilers in general can actually lead more people to enjoy things. Now, as far as how much or how little you enjoy it, the professor, I wrote his name down, but my notes didn't sync.
Christenfeld.
Yes. So his theory is that by taking that piece out of it, right, by already knowing what's happening beforehand, you can actually enjoy all of these other things that are going on. And I don't 100% I don't relate to that experience necessarily, but I have had many experiences where I'll go to a movie and I guess it's specific to the type of person that you're talking about, but, like, I get so excited about watching certain movies and certain TV shows that I really do have, like, this emotional roller coaster during the first viewing that I have to go back and watch it a second time. And the second time that I watch it, it's like where was I the first time? How come I don't remember all this stuff? Like, how come I didn't notice this or that other thing? And I think that taking those things in isolation, any of those experiences in isolation, is an attempt at trying to justify or vilify spoiler culture. But I think they're all part of the viewing experience. Some people will never watch something again, and their only experience will have been that one time they saw it. And I don't think that the spoilers are that big of an issue, because I honestly cannot – I've been trying to think about, when have I gone to see a movie where I knew the surprise because it was spoiled from a trailer or from something else, and I hated the experience because of it. And I think I wanted to hate the experience, but I don't think that I actually did, if the show was good enough that the spoiler wasn't it. Because I know that some things are just garbage, right? And the spoiler is like the best part, right? Or the only good part.
Right.
And if that's spoiled, that's very different than something that's like just generally really enjoyable and good, and one part of it was spoiled.
Right.
Or you know everything that's happening, but the ride is still fun.
Yeah, I mean, it's the quality of the content. Again, Game of Thrones, I knew exactly what was happening, but it was still really, really enjoyable to watch it play out.
Yeah. And like the versions of the characters on the show are very different than what you imagined when you read it the right. first time, I'm sure, because they're not exactly the same. There's a lot there.
I feel like spoilers don't necessarily have to ruin the experience if it's a good piece of work, but I do feel that spoilers neuter the emotional experience. You know, because if there is a big plot point or if there is a big twist, they're usually designed to have a significant emotional impact on the viewer or the reader. And
well, I think neuter is a powerful word, especially like that. I think that assumes that the person is going to watch it once. You know?
I don't think so.
Like you can also design for multiple repeat viewings, and you would design that a little differently. Because The Sixth Sense is, you're right, after that first time it's completely different. But not everything is like that.
No, but if I went in the first time I saw it, I already knew the twist ending, I'm not going to have the emotional reaction that I did when I didn't know. And so that's what I mean by maybe mute is a better, or temper the emotional experience. And that's just on the individual level. That doesn't even touch the social level of finding out in real time with your friends and colleagues about what happened. You know, that's also a really powerful social experience, is experiencing something in the moment with people you care about. That's why sports are so popular. You know, everybody watches the Super Bowl. Well, not everybody. A lot of people watch the Super Bowl, even if they, one, don't like the teams that are playing, or if they don't even like football itself. It's kind of the shared emotional experience of the highs and lows when you don't know what's coming, as opposed to if you went back and watched a previous Super Bowl and you already knew who the winner would be, the excitement wouldn't be there. The suspense of, you know, will Eli Manning throw that ridiculous Tyree helmet catch? Like, you already know that's going to happen. You know the Giants are going to beat the Patriots. So the emotional turmoil is not there. But that might free you up to look at it more analytically. Like, oh, this was a mistake the Patriots made. This was a mistake the Giants made. So
Or just like, that game was amazing. You won't believe what happened. This is what happened. And then I'm like, oh, well, then I want to see that game.
And then, yeah. And so you'll see it and you'll enjoy it. But, you know, I remember when that catch happened that we had friends over, and I distinctly remember one of my friends jumping up and being so excited that he spilled beer on the ceiling. You know, that kind of Fiero moment, to take a McGonagall word, I feel like isn't going to happen when you already know the outcome. Doesn't mean it's not enjoyable.
Exactly. And the point is that, does that mean that the whole experience is ruined?
No.
According to these two studies in particular, he says that people report enjoying things. And I think it's a good way to ask it, right? Like, did you enjoy it? And can you rate your enjoyment? And apparently, the people that he studied reported enjoying things more despite Maybe the best word is despite having something being spoiled instead of because it was spoiled.
Again, I think it really comes down to, I would be fascinated to know if he took baselines on the kind of people that he was assessing. I mean, there's some people who are extra tensive, that they live in their emotions and that's where they find their joy and, no pun intended, but their joy and their happiness comes from experiencing those emotions, as opposed to people who are maybe more cerebral, logical kind of people who enjoy looking at things analytically or critically. And so I think that has a large part to do with it as well. I'm definitely one of the more live in the emotions kind of people. And so if something's going to be enjoyable for me, it's probably going to have a strong emotional impact to it. Now, again, the emotion itself doesn't have to be enjoyable, because again, there are several times in Games of Thrones where the emotion I'm experiencing is unenjoyable, such as anxiety or stress or feeling unfulfilled because I don't know what's going to happen or I feel like I'm left hanging. But the experience of having intense emotional reactions is enjoyable, even if the emotional reaction itself is not. But that's in my case, and that's for me.
Yeah, and really the point of today's episode was to show you that you don't know what you know. You think you know, but you don't really. Like even as we're trying to explain how we enjoy things, if there's an objective, right, roundabout way to measure that enjoyment, right? Nobody's like this was all self-report. This was not, nobody was hooked up to a machine here to actually measure levels of anything. But it's a way to, we may think that we enjoy this thing more, but that it's possible that we don't actually. Like cognitively, we're thinking about it and we're like, no, but my experience tells me this. But really, that may not be true. So sharing information, and you may think, it's not doing anything, but it could be. And again, we explained that it's possibly or probably best explained just by cognitive load. Like you're just doing too many things at one time, so it's hard to appreciate it. And to an extent, that kind of applies to the second part too, right? But really the message is like, just because you hate spoilers doesn't mean they actually ruin everything moving forward. And I think that even just moving watching something or going to watch something with the knowledge that, you know, it's possible that my experience isn't now ruined because I know this piece of information. Like just going into it with that mindset will probably increase your enjoyment of it too, because you're not going in with like all these negative feelings. So it's possible.
The farthest I'm willing to accede is that spoilers do not necessarily ruin the experience, but they do unequivocally change it. And so if you prefer one kind
possibly
of experience
for the better,
maybe,
according to the study.
Maybe.
Possibly.
But it depends on what kind of experience you want. That's different for everybody.
No, according to the study, it just makes them better.
Yeah, well, I disagree. Until I see the procedures and the methods, I will hold my seat. And again, I will entertain the idea that for some people it might be more enjoyable, but I'm going to hold it right there. I'm holding the
again,
line.
Again, unless you measure like pleasure sensors in the brain, you really won't know for sure. Like,
or defining what it even means to enjoy something.
Yeah. Well, that's why like I'm saying, like, you know, like pleasure at a chemical level, at a neurological level, if we can measure that, then we'd know for sure. But I find it very interesting.
And I'm kind
of siding with, like, yeah, because I can keep coming up with examples where I'm like, you know what? I don't even care that the thing was spoiled anymore, because now that's like one of my favorite movies. And that one surprise experience isn't a thing. Damn, we went really deep into spoiler culture, and that wasn't really my intention. But, you know, there you go, Brent. You got your Game of Thrones talk on PsychTech.
Oh, there'll be more. I'll find some way to sneak it. I'll do it for you, Brent. I'll sneak it in somehow.
We'll figure something out. This has been PsychTech, the Psychology and Technology Podcast. For more episodes or more information about us, or to reach out, even if we take a long time to answer, We eventually will. And remind us, and we'll definitely get back to you. So we're at psychtechpodcast.com or psychtechcast on Twitter, and we'll be back soon.
Hashtag Team Kelly if you support my side. Hashtag Team Loser if you support Hostwise.
That's not nice, Kelly. Let's get out of here.